segment three, Young David, page 25 in your syllabus. And we start in 1 Samuel 16 in our Bibles with the first verse. 1 Samuel 16:1, we read, "And the Lord said unto Samuel, how long are you going to cry, whine, and mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill thy horn with oil and go, and I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons." See, God didn't set Saul up for failure. But once Saul, by his freedom of will, disobeyed God, God, by foreknowledge, already knew that another leader for Israel would be needed and had one available. Here in your syllabus, we got 1 Samuel 13:13. And Samuel said to Saul, "Idiot, fool, dummy, you have done foolishly. For thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever, but now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee." So from back then, Saul knew, Samuel knew, we just didn't know who it was going to be yet. You know, which pitcher they're bringing up from the minors? Who's going to be the next prophet? All right. Now, the Messiah's line was to be from the tribe of Judah, not from the tribe of Benjamin, Saul's heritage. So if they had, read the Old Testament scrolls, they would have known it's probably going to be somebody from Judah next. 1 Samuel 16:2. "And Samuel said, I can't go anywhere. Saul's got a secret service, SS, out there. His KGB, they're keeping an eye on me." If Saul hears it, he's going to kill me. And the Lord said, all right, here's what you do. Here's the plan. Take a heifer with you and say, I am come to sacrifice to the Lord. All right, now look in your syllabus. Look how specific the revelation is. God gives Samuel the seer precise information that would be needed to skirt Saul's inquiries. Before there was a king, the judge who had the Spirit of God upon him could freely go to wherever and do whatever God needed him to do. He was the person in charge spiritually, so he could go anywhere. That God said, go here or go there. Now, even the prophet has to answer to the king. Part of the function of the prophet was to keep the king doing the will of God. Since Saul had lost the Spirit and knew that God would anoint another king by the hand of Samuel, the prophet was being watched. Helicopters circling his house and all kinds of things like that are happening. All right. So how do I go? I just can't just take a walk. There'll be somebody following me. So God told him specifically, take a heifer, go like you're going to offer a sacrifice. All right, 1 Samuel 16:3. "Call Jesse to that sacrifice, and I will show thee what thou shalt do. And thou shalt anoint unto me him whom I name unto thee." And imagine that. Samuel did that which the Lord spake. And guess what? It worked. Huh. Let's see that. So he comes to Bethlehem. And the elders of the town trembled. You know, and the prophet walks in the town. And I love, "Comest thou peaceably?" When the prophet showed up, usually there's only one reason why he was there. And it usually wasn't a very good reason. "Comest thou peaceably?" Because the prophet, basically, this was outside the normal visiting cycle. Remember, we saw where he went to here. He went to Mizpah. He went to Cleveland. He went to Miami. He'd go to these different places. But instead, Bethlehem was too small. So you'd go to Gilgal if you wanted to, in that area instead. So in fact, it says it here in 1 Samuel 7:16 in your syllabus. He went from year to year from Bethel to Gilgal to Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all those places. See, Bethlehem was a small town, not on the prophet's usual itinerary. And they knew the potential as to why a prophet of God could show up, many times because of the need for reproof in an area. Comest thou peaceably? All right, look at Romans 13 here. This is addressing us today. "Let every soul be in subjection to the exceeding authorities. In fact, there is no real authority except from God. And those that exist have been appointed by God. Therefore, those who oppose that authority resist the disposition or the arrangement or the direction of God. And those who resist it will receive judgment against themselves. Pianos or anvils or will fall on them or something like that. Or they'll fall off a cliff and a wildy coyote. Moreover, these leaders are not a source of fear to the good work, but to the evil work. Do you want to not be afraid of the authority? Then do that which is good, and you'll have praise from the same. Certainly a minister of God is for your good. However, if you do that which is evil, then be afraid. For he does not... that thus shouldn't be there. For he does not wear the sword without reason. Certainly a minister of God is an avenger for wrath to him who practices that which is evil. So that lays it into today, but that's the same spirit of what was going on in that time frame with Samuel. This passage refers to the excelling authorities commissioned by God for the purpose of administering his services and justice. Back to 1 Samuel 16. And Samuel did that which the Lord spake, and he comes to Bethlehem, and the elders of the town trembled at his coming, and said, "Comest thou peaceably?" And he said, "Yes, peaceably." And they all went, "Phew. I am come to sacrifice unto the Lord, so sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." And he sanctified Jesse and his sons and called them to the sacrifice. Now Jesse has 8 sons and 2 daughters, and David was the youngest son. Did Samuel tell Jesse why he had come? Did Samuel know that the Christ line was going to go through Jesse? We don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. 1 Samuel 16:6. And it came to pass, when they were come, that he looked on Eliab and said, "Ah, surely this is the Lord's anointed, is before him. 6'5", 220, runs, you know, the 40 and 4.3, definitely." That's from the football combine. Okay. All right. Saul, remember Saul, he was quite a physical specimen. Head and shoulders above everyone else. Tallest man in the kingdom. So Samuel's comparing David's sons to Saul by the flesh. Now, if the first son looked this good, by the time we get to the 8th son, we're going to see that David was from good stock. You know, David wasn't Michael Cerna, okay? we'll see that. All right. 1 Samuel 16:7. "But the Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance, or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. For man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." So, even at an early age, David had impressed God with his heart. All right, 1 Samuel 16:8, "And Jesse called Abinadab, the next son, come on down, Abinadab." And he passed before Samuel. And God says to Samuel, "Neither has the Lord chosen him." Then Jesse made Shammah to pass by. And he said, "Neither had the Lord chosen this." Again, Jesse made 7 of his sons to pass before Samuel. And Samuel said unto Jesse, "The Lord hasn't chosen these." And Samuel said unto Jesse, "Is this it? You got any more children?" And he went, "Well, I got one, the youngest one, but you know, he's out working. He's taking care of the sheep." And Samuel said unto Jesse, "Send and fetch him. For we will not sit down," in other words, we're not going to eat until he comes here. And if you want to eat, you better go get him hurt quickly. He was the youngest son, which of course culturally was all wrong. His father did have enough confidence in him, though, even at a young age, he was trustworthy enough to be left alone to care for and protect the sheep. He probably had some household servants working with him there. So, 1 Samuel 16:12. "And he sent and brought him in." Now he was ruddy, reddish, and with all of a beautiful countenance, and goodly to look to. So he was a male model. "And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he." Many believe he's about 15 years of age at this time. 1 Samuel 16:13. "Then Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him in the midst of his brethren, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went home to Ramoth." All right. The first thing David needed was to receive the Spirit from God. It was the first thing Saul had received earlier. In the records in the Old Testament, the proof that you had received the Spirit is that you had prophesied. There is no record of David doing that here. All that is recorded is that David was anointed, and because of his anointing, he had received the Spirit. There is no mention of him, though, being king, or that his brothers knowing about his future. He could have been anointing the next prophet, as far as they know. I mean, Saul, you know, Samuel got up, anointed him, and it doesn't say, did he give any background information? Nothing's mentioned. the way his brothers are going to treat him. I don't think they know yet, because if he's going to be king, like, you know, Joseph got all those dreams, and his brother sure didn't like it. Didn't treat him very well. So it may be just anointing him, got the Spirit. And the anointing is, okay, when you anoint somebody, it specifically sets you apart for a specific purpose. Messiah, Christ, both means the anointed one. They have a special purpose, a special reason, a special mission. And so that's what this was. He anointed him, but there's no record of him telling anybody exactly. David may be the first person to go to the moon. We don't know, you know, what the anointing was about. All right, in your syllabus still, 1 Samuel 16:14, remember it said, but the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. The Spirit from God, before the Feast of Pentecost, recorded in Acts 2, was given upon a condition. The condition was that you could lose it. It had been put upon people in the Old Testament to perform a certain function for the Lord. Since Pentecost, the Spirit from God is given unconditionally to all who believe regarding His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. Timothy, read 1 Peter 1:23 for us.
Being born again, not of corruptible seed, but of incorruptible, by the Word of God, which liveth and abideth forever.
Right. It's incorruptible seed that we've given today. You can't lose it. You can't leave it at Walmart. First, you can't even get it there, though. 1 Samuel 16:14 again, the first word is but. This marks and introduces a later event, placed here in order to bring out and connect the contrast of the Spirit's departing from Saul and coming upon David. 1 Samuel 16:14 says, but the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord troubled or terrified him. It didn't come from the true God. That is that Hebrew idiom of permission. God allowed an evil spirit from the devil to torment Saul. Saul's actions brought this upon himself. Here, Genesis 6:5. Russell, if you could read that. This is great insight to natural man.
And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually.
This is a great overall statement of what natural man without the Spirit from God, can do. They just think evil continually. Wickedness is great. That's all they have to live by. So we go to chapter 16, verse 15, back in our Bibles. So that's natural man, thinking evil all the time. Why? Because that's all he can do. Go by their senses. And that's what they do. 1 Samuel 16:15 says, and Saul's servant said unto him, behold now, an evil spirit from God troubleth thee. Again, what we're doing is we're not looking at this chronologically. We're basically continuing and dealing with the spirit. Spirit on David. Spirit left Saul. The resultant factor of what happened is being filled in now. Then we'll go back chronologically and pick up the story. All right. In 16:15, and Saul's servants said unto him, hey, an evil spirit from God troubled thee. Well, if they had no comprehension at all about evil spirits, they wouldn't have said something like this. They didn't have the depth of it. I mean, I probably ought to just read what I wrote. Those closest to Saul recognized that something wasn't quite right with Saul. You know, his head was spinning around. And they didn't have the spiritual understanding we have today because of the teachings and accomplishments of Jesus Christ. But they realized that Saul wasn't the same. 16:16. Let our Lord now command thy servants, which are before thee, to seek out a man who is a cunning player of the harp, a skillful player on the lyre. The lyre is just a small harp. And, it's a good thing the accordion hadn't been invented yet. So. And it shall come to pass, when the evil spirit from God is upon thee, that he shall play with his hand, and thou shalt be well. The king, in your syllabus, the king's servant sought a man who was a skillful player on the lyre, which is a small harp, in order to help the king feel better. They recognized the influence music can have on one's life, both good and bad. Despite the influence music has on people, the Word of God has more. Hebrews 4:12, the working translation. Lizzie, if you could read that for us, please.
Certainly the Word of God is living and powerfully active and sharper than every double-edged sword, even penetrating to the dividing between soul and spirit, and also between joints and marrow, and it is able to judge between the thoughts and intentions of the heart.
Right. So, music is great, it will influence people, but the Word of God goes right to the heart of the situation. 1 Samuel 16:17. All right, Lindell, if you could read that one verse for us.
And Saul said unto his servants, provide me now a man that can play well and bring him to me.
Yeah, I don't want no amateur. Let's get somebody who knows what he's doing. All right. So, but Saul recognized, you know, Saul also agreed, you know, I need help. Maybe this will help me. Okay, so verse 18 says, then I answered one of his servants and said, you know, we've been scouting this son of Jesse, and he's skillful in playing music, and he's a mighty valiant man, and he's a man of war, and he's prudent in matters, and he's a comely person, and the Lord seems to be with him. So, in your syllabus, we'll look at David's credentials. This is the back of his baseball card. You know, this is how others perceived David at an early age in his life. I've been observing, keeping watch for the best in the kingdom to be utilized for the king's purposes. Jesse has a son who is not only a skillful musician, but a sturdy, brave man, a fighter, has understanding of intelligent speech or of a sound judgment, an attractive man, well-built, personable, and his biggest attribute is the Lord is with him. I think I'll hire him. David was well-schooled. He was still young, but his ability shined brightly wherever he went. A man's gift, his training and commitment to being the best makes room for him. Proverbs 18:16. Edgar, if you could read that for us, please.
A man's gifts maketh room for him and bringeth him before great men.
Right. It's interesting. Some translations have that, a man's bribe. If you bribe people, then you'll get, you know. They just totally missed the whole context of this thing. I was actually surprised how many verses had that in it that dealt with that. No, a man's gift, you know, being around, showing interest, wanting to learn, to grow, you know. 1 Samuel 16:19. Back to our Bible. All right, Susanna, what's 1 Samuel 16:19 say?
Therefore, Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me David, your son, who is with the sheep."
There was nothing Jesse could do about it. He can't say no. He's my kid. I need him to work. He just lost a shepherd. He just lost a valuable employee who happened to be a son to the king. King said, "Send me your son." What are you going to do? What can you do?
Can't do anything.
Yeah. Gee, isn't having a king a good thing? The prophet can't walk around freely. He just takes whoever he wants and whatever he wants. Oh, I want a king. No. Where are we at? We're in verse 20. And Jesse took an ass laden with bread and a bottle of wine and a kid and sent them by David, his son, unto Saul. You never went to a man in authority, a king, the prophet, your bookie, you know, without a gift. You always brought the man in authority something. That's what they did here. All right, verse 21, and David said to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer, squire. Basically, took, you know, and Saul sent to Jesse saying, "Let David, I pray thee, stand before me, for he hath found favor in my sight." Well, what could David's father say? Take my other kids. No, I'm thankfully only got one. I got eight of them. I got a bunch still working around the farm here. Saul was king. The king didn't have to ask permission. 1 Samuel 16:23, Timothy.
And it came to pass, when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, that David took an harp and played with his hand. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him.
Right. Some have taught that, you know, David plays the music, and we're not sure, because it doesn't really say that. Maybe he sang psalms to God, you know, the psalms that he later wrote, different praises to God, that he would sing also. At the same time, that as he was playing the music, he'd be singing these different psalms. It was the word that really drove, you know, that added to the music that drove him out. We don't know for sure. It doesn't really say. But anyway, Saul would grow calm and recover from his spirit of sadness, or the evil mood would leave him. He'd smoke a cigarette and relax. Now, 1 Samuel 17 is chronologically a continuation from 16:13. An author's right is claimed for placing the later episode, 16:14-23, first, in order to connect and contrast the two spirits from Saul and David. The canonical order alternates David's call and Saul's. So we move to chapter 17 of 1 Samuel. And Jerry, could you read 1-4 for us?
Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle, and were gathered together at Shokah, which belongeth in Judah, and pitched between Shokah and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah, and set the battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. And there went out a champion of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span.
Now the word champion literally means a duelist, a middleman, a man between two intermediaries. The Jerusalem Bible translated, one of the shock troopers stepped out. I thought that was great. Knox has it, they had a champion, a bastard born. The actual length of a cubit varied according to nation and variety. So there are many discrepancies as to the actual size of the Philistines' giant Goliath. The Egyptian cubit of 20.62 inches, which Moses was familiar with, was used as the standard measure for the books of the Pentateuch, the first 5 books of the Bible. The New Bible Dictionary by J.D. Douglas on pages 1321 and 1322, under weights and measures, lists a cubit as a distance from the elbow to the fingertip. Elbow to the fingertip. So do you think mine might be a little different than Matt Wood's? From the elbow to the... So it would vary, wouldn't it? Yours would probably be a little bit smaller. Huh? Yeah. Compared to yours. Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay. So we start seeing discrepancies here. All right. The natural cubit was used to indicate the general size of a person, with 4 cubits being the height of a man. So a typical man was 4 cubits. A more precise defined cubit was used for exact measurements. The standard Hebrew cubit was 17.5 inches, slightly shorter than the common Egyptian cubit, 17.6 inches. The Hebrew long, so you had a short cubit and a long cubit. The Hebrew long or royal cubit was a hand breadth longer, so a whole hand breadth longer, all right, than the standard cubit of 6 palms. So it was 20.4 inches. The Egyptian long cubit was 20.65 inches. The Babylonian cubit, in case you're interested, was 19.8 inches. And again, I'm putting this in here to kind of give us an idea of how big this guy really was. The span, you know, it says that he was 6 cubits in a span. The span, or outstretched hand from thumb to little finger. So from here to here, that's a span. From here to here was a span. Okay. And it was called a half cubit many times. Okay. Since there are 2 potential lengths for the cubit, there will be 2 measurements given. So I'm going to give you 2 measurements. One will be based upon the size of a Hebrew standard or natural cubit of the 17.5 inches. The other measure will be the 20.4 inches based on the Hebrew long or royal cubit. So 17.4, Timothy, again.
And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span.
Okay, so putting in both of those figures, Goliath then was either about 9.5 feet tall or slightly taller than 11 feet. So with the smaller cubit, he's 9.5 feet tall. If you go with the bigger cubit, he's a little over 11 feet tall. Either way, okay, that is a big boy. All right. The New International Version and the Berkeley translation said that he was over 9 feet tall, which is about 3 meters. James Moffat has him about 10 feet tall. All right, to put this into perspective, the basketball player Shaquille O'Neal is only 7 feet 1 inch tall and 325 pounds. Is there anybody in this room that big? No. When you see him, you go, oh, look, a little guy. No, it isn't, you know, with Michael Hartman or whatever, the black guy, or what's the real short guy, what?
Kevin Hart.
Kevin Hart. That's it, yeah. No, we're not dealing with him. We're dealing with Shaq. Okay, Kevin Hart, all right. All right, Shaq, 7 feet, exactly, yeah. 7 feet 1 inch, 325 pounds. That's large.
Me on top of me.
But what we really have is, okay, what we really have is guy over 9 or over 11. So he's between 9 feet and 11 feet. Today he'd be playing basketball, you know. And they, so So, exactly. Right. All right. The heck with this war stuff. I'm playing basketball. I'll do better. You know, how about that for defensive linemen? All right. So, there's been lots of different things out there, but based upon what the Bible Dictionary, who has done the research of weights and measures, he's between 9 to 11 feet tall, and Shaq is only a mere 7 feet tall. All right. So he comes walking out of the army. Hello. Verse 5:17:5. And he had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. His armor weighed 125 pounds. Brass can be copper, bronze, brass, or a combination of them. Bronze is not mentioned in the scripture. And true brass, which is an alloy of copper and zinc, was not known until around 1000 BC, which is the time frame of David and Solomon. Bronze was common during Abraham's life and the patriarchal time. His armament was probably made of a form of bronze, an alloy of copper and tin. So a lot of times the Bible will say brass, and it doesn't mean the shiny brass. You know, it's more of a copper with some kind of an alloy in it to make it a little bit more malleable, and it doesn't turn green in the rain. You know, as it wears a little bit. All right, in verse 6 it says, he had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. Greaves of brass were his boots, terminating at the ankle. They were made in one plate of metal, but round to the shape of the leg, and often lined with felt or sponge. Because you can imagine if it was just brass, you know, it'd be like trying to wear that. So they would put some sponge or, you know, Dr. Scholl's ancestors had something in there for him. They were useful in guarding the legs, and not only against the spikes of the enemy, but in crossing through areas thick with thorns and briars. If you ever cross through some fields sometimes, it hurts. And so this would keep you as you walk through fields. Now, the target of brass was a circular frame holding a bronze javelin slung across his back shoulders. So it's kind of like, you know, you put a thing on your shoulders and he's got a spear back here that he can pull out. So that's what the target of brass was, and he had a spear back there. Of course, it was his bronze javelin, and it was 5 feet long. 1 Samuel 17:7, Timothy.
Getting there. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him.
So his spear is about 5 feet long, and it's as large as the long rod that was used in cloth production, whose head was about 15 pounds worth of iron. The top of his spear, thing out, like, you know, like a flagpole. Yeah, round flagpole thing. That was 15 pounds on top of it. All right. By comparison, to give you an idea, a typical professional baseball bat weighs about 36 ounces and is 35 inches long. So a baseball bat is about 3 feet. His was 5. All right. And it had a big flagpole part on the top of it. So, and it weighs 36 ounces versus 15 pounds. So an intimidating sight. All right, 1 Samuel 17:8-11. And he stood. It's one of those where they didn't have binoculars, but they could see this guy was quite a bit bigger than everybody else when he stepped out. And he stood, and he cried unto the armies of Israel and said, why are you come out to set your battle in array? And not I a Philistine, and you servants to Saul? Choose a man for you and let him come down to me. If he be able to fight with me and kill me, then will we be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall you be our servants, and you'll have to serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. It's time. Or as his brother Michael Buffett would say, let's get ready to rumble. The guy, I guess, who does the MMA beginning part of that is his brother, Michael Buffett. And they didn't even know they had brothers until they were in their 40s. It's an interesting story. All right, anyway. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed. And they were greatly afraid. They were terror-stricken. Yeah, you do it. No, you do it. But you better not lose. All right. And then enter David. 1 Samuel 17:15. But David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. All right, since Saul went off to war, you don't need a musician. He didn't take him. So Jesse's youngest son, all of 16, 17 years old now, went home to go back to work because his brothers had been drafted into the army. So he went home. And the Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself for 40 days. 40 days you had to look at this guy. He stepped out in the morning and he came back and, you know, after supper. Anybody, you know, feel good? Ready to take me on now? And Jesse said unto David, take now for thy brother an ephod of this parched corn and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to thy brother and carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000 and look how thy brethren fare and take their pledge. So basically, David was sent to the camp of Israel to deliver to the commander of his brother's regiment 10 soft milk cheeses from Wisconsin and to return to his dad with a report on how his brother's welfare were. How's your brother's doing? So, verse 20. So David rose up early in the morning. He's eager to get there. And he left the sheep with a keeper. He had a herdsman, you know, an assistant. And he took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment, the trench, as the host was going forth to the fight and shouted for the battle. So David arrived just as the armies were moving up into formation on top of the hill where they face each other every morning, where the Goliath steps out. And he gets there just in time to watch everybody get ready. And the two sides are facing each other. 17:22. And David left his carriage, the provisions, in the hands of the keeper of the carriage, the, you know, keeper of the stores. And he ran into the army, as David, you could imagine. And he came and slew his brother. So David joined the battle lines. Hey, we're going to have a fight. All right, I'm just in time for the action. He doesn't know really what's going on. And as he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines. And he spake according to the same words, and David heard him. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, they fled from him, and they feared exceedingly. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man? Have you seen the size of this monster? It's Godzilla that's come up, surely to defy Israel as he come up. And it shall be that the man, now listen, these guys are talking amongst themselves, whoever kills that guy, the king's going to enrich him with great riches, he'll give him his daughter, and he'll make his father's house free in Israel. Anybody want that? But nobody wanted anything to do with the size of that monster, so they feared exceedingly. But something did catch David's attention. He went, what was that? Great riches? King's daughter? Father's house free? Tell me a little bit more about this. So David asks for clarification. 17:26, Andrew.
And David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?
Whoa, that doesn't sound like he's terror-stricken like everybody else, does it? This shows David's attitude towards his God. A little insight into his heart. His God was a living, caring, personal, helpful God. It wasn't a statue made of wood or metal or an idol with no real power. It wasn't St. Christopher metal, you know, something like that. 1 Samuel 17:27. And the people answered him after this manner, saying, so shall it be done to the man that killeth him. And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men. And Eliab's typical older brother, his anger was kindled against David and said, will you come down here? Why have you left a few sheep to the wilderness? I know your pride and your foolishness of heart. But thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. And David's like, hey, what have I done? Isn't there a reason for me being here? Hey, you know, our dad sent me. Am I wrong for asking questions? Verse 30. So what does he do? He turned from him toward another person and spake after the same manner. And the people answered him of the former manner. He's going, okay, let me get this right. Okay. Right? Riches, king's daughter, freedom, fame, a spot on Dancing with the Stars. I like this. Okay. Verse 31. And when the words were heard which David spake, they reported them to Saul, and they sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail. What are you guys losing courage for? Because of this, you know, because of him. Thy sir, I'll go fight the Philistine. And Saul looked at David. Excuse me, but you're not able to go against the Philistine to fight with them. You're but a youth. You're just a kid. You know? And he's a man of war. He's a trained soldier from his youth. And David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep. And there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. Some people think it's a lion or a bear. But as I've looked through this, I think it's both. God, in other words, had been preparing him for this moment by building his confidence in life and death situations against rather large, fierce opponents already. I don't know how many of you have wrestled the bear while the bear was hungry and was trying to take some food, or a lion. Okay. 1 Samuel 17:35. And I went out after him. I chased the bear. I chased the lion, you know, and it attacked me. I went out after him and smote him. I attacked him, and I rescued it out of thy mouth, the little lamb. I got it from its jaws. And when, you know, I knocked it down, and when he arose against me, when he turned back towards me, I caught him by his beard, by his chin whiskers, and I smote him, and I strangled him. So David's basically saying, look, while I'm out taking care of the sheep, a bear came up. I grabbed it by its chin whiskers, wounded, and then I killed it. Well, that's a close encounter. Hand-to-hand combat with a bear and a lion. All right. 1736. The servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, saying he has defiled. He dared to insult the armies of the living God. I can see these guys walking along and go, man, this kid's got some gumption. Either that or he's really crazy. David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. So if you're Saul, we can say, been 30 days, nobody's doing anything. Go ahead, what the heck? There you go. And the Lord be with you, son. And Saul armed David with his armor. Now, Saul, remember, his head and shoulders above everybody, and his armor's rather large. You want to put your armor on her? Okay, it's not going to work. All right. And put his helmet of brass upon his head, you know. Also, he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword about his armor, and he struggled to go. But because he hadn't proved it, he hadn't tried them, he wasn't used to that equipment. And David said to Saul, I can't go with these. I haven't proved them. And David took them off, and he put a staff in his hand, and he chose 5 smooth stones out of the brook. The first time I went to this area, everybody, when the bus stopped, you all jumped out and looked for smooth stones. So we all grabbed the smooth stone in the valley, in this valley where this happened. So everybody was looking for the right stone. I have no idea where it is today, but I had one, a smooth stone, out of the brook, and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had, even in a satchel. And a sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistines came on and drew near unto David. And the man that bare the shield went before him. Okay, Saul was so big, his shield was so big, that he had an armor bearer just to not only carry the one shield. And it was bigger than him, this Saul's shield. That was his job, was to carry the shield out. So Goliath, excuse me. Yeah, Goliath. Yeah, so Goliath has got an armor bearer who's just carrying a shield out. And, you know, the big, you know, you're carrying it out, and he's walking behind it, and he looks, and who is this punk? You're sending this against me? He was not happy, right? So, and when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he scorned him, for he was but a little boy with fresh complexion. He was very, you know, he didn't have any acne. And he was a fair countenance. He was very attractive. So here's this young boy, fair complexion, no acne, and he didn't look anything like a warrior is supposed to look, right? No armor, no shield, no sword, no lightsaber. So, you know, he's got no weapons. 1743. And the Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves, with a club? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Wrong approach. All right, he kind of saw David's staff. You know, he had a little bit of a club. But he did not see the sling or the belief in his opponent's heart that he expected his God would make sure that he prevailed. This is Romans 8:37 in action. Believing he was a super conqueror and acting accordingly, totally expecting success. 1 Samuel 17:44. Ah, Goliath has joined us. And the Philistine said... Now, the Philistine is talking. He's not whispering. He's yelling. You're in a valley, and you know, you got your good acoustics and all of that. And he's and he's yelling so everybody can hear, and he's yelling at David, "Come to me, and I will give thy flesh to the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. I'm going to break you in half with my bare hands and feed you to the birds. And let, you know, all the vultures come in and take you, and the hyenas, and everybody will fight over you." Then said David to the Philistine, "Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you've insulted." He was pretty confident, wasn't he? He's a real cocky 17-year-old. You know? He was very confident. What was that? He was very confident in his God and what his God promises and the power of his God. Hey, he took out a bear and a lion already. And that was hand-to-hand combat. Here, he's going to stay his distance a little bit. All right. 1 Samuel 17:46. "This day will the Lord..." "This day the Lord's going to..." "This day the Lord will deliver thee into my hand, and I will kill you, and I'm going to cut off your head, and I'll give the carcass of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there's a God in Israel. I'm doing it for God's glory." Not for my own glory. Of course, I kind of like the side benefits from what I was hearing about, but it's for God's glory. We're going to do this. "And all this assembly shall know..." Everybody's going to know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear. "For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. He's going to put you at our mercy." And it came to pass when the Philistine rose. That had to make him mad, Goliath. So when he rose and he started heading towards David, that David hasted. I think he kind of faked left and ran right. You know, and ran toward the ranks. He ran to meet the Philistine. That had to really, you know, Goliath is like, "What is this idiot doing?" Right? David attacked. Remember when we read about the lion and the bear? They grabbed the animal. He attacked them. Same. So he's using the same, you know, technique. He could patent it after this. All right, 1 Samuel 17:49. "And David put his hand in his bag, and he took thence a stone." Why did he take five stones? For grace. And now he's just going to need one stone. And he slung it. And he smote the Philistine in the forehead, that the stone sank. It penetrated into his forehead. This guy probably had a 95-mile-an-hour fastball with that sling. You know? Right into the forehead. "And he fell upon his face to the earth." Excuse me, I have a note here saying it was like being hit with a 98-mile-an-hour fastball, not just a 95 one. You know, let's take it up a few degrees. All right. Like getting hit with a 98-mile-an-hour fastball right here. Boom. All right. There was a teaching at one time ago where, you know how in baseball, you got knee pad, the catcher has knee pads on, shin guards, and when you bend like this, there's an opening there. Some people have taught that it hit him there, when he was running, Glass was running, it'd be an opening and hit him there, and he dropped there, and then he took him. It doesn't really make sense because the way he fell and all of that. But that was one of the older teachings that was presented, which I don't believe is accurate. So I think he hit him in the forehead with a 98-mile-an-hour stone and dropped him. All right. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and he smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Right? He just had a club, small, and five stones. Therefore David ran. Boom, he dropped the Philistine in the spot, and he took the Philistine's sword, and he drew it out of his sheath and slew him, and he cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistine saw their champion was dead, what do? You run. What the heck? He's standing there holding this huge head. And he just cut off. Here's your champion. No, here's your champion. Uh-oh. All right. Again, this is common in this day and time. Not something we do a whole lot today when we win, you know, at the end of the hockey matches, you cut off your opponent's heads and parade them around. That's not quite, you know, you only do this if you're in Nigeria or something. All right. So they fled. And the men of Israel and the men of Judah, they arose and shouted, and they pursued the Philistines after they came to the valley. And they went all the way to the gates of Ekron, and they wounded of the Philistines, and they fell down by the way of Shaaron and Gath and Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. You know, they took everybody's American Express cards. And David took the head of the Philistine, and he brought it to Jerusalem, and he put his armor in his tent. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said to Abner, Abner was the captain of his army, said, "Whose son is this youth?" And Abner says, "My soul liveth, O king, I don't know. I never saw this kid before." Now, all right, he had been there. I don't know how he missed it, okay? If he had already been there playing the music, and now, but Saul's kind of like got other problems and troubles and things. I mean, he kind of went, you know, if you got 150 employees, basically, and a new guy shows up at work, yeah, okay, nice, you know, and just goes on. He didn't really recognize them and put it together because he's going to start playing for him full-time afterwards. That becomes his new gig, one of his new gigs, actually. So I don't know who this is. And the king said, "Find out who this strapling is, this youth is." And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his head. Yeah, this is the kid who did it. He's still got Goliath's head still. That's right. And Saul said unto him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of thy servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." Remember, one of the promises was his family would be free? Mm-hmm. That's a big deal. So he made sure, "Hey, Jesse from Bethlehem, he's my dad. Free us." All right, 1 Samuel 18:1. Well, of course, Saul's going to keep his word in all of this. Chuckle, chuckle, nod, wink, wink. 1 Samuel 18:1. Yeah. "And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own." Now, in your syllabus, Jonathan was Saul's oldest son. He was the firstborn. According to custom, he would have been the one to eventually fight Goliath. After a period of time, it would fall into his hands, and he would have to go out and do it, fight him. So he's real thankful. But he also he sees David's heart. He sees that David's doing this in the name of the living God. And that's really what knit them together. And Saul, verse 2, of chapter 18, "And Saul took him that day and would not let him go no more home to his father's house. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant of friendship because he loved him as his own soul." Jonathan's in his 40s. David was 16, 17 years old at the time. And, of course, you have the unbelievers who are saying this becomes a homosexual relationship. No, it's further from that. But, you know, you always got these kind of people. They're always throwing this stuff out there. All right, 18:4. "And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and to his girdle or belt. And David went out whithersoever Saul sent him. And David behaved himself like Johnny Manziel and went crazy and did all kinds of..." No, he behaved himself wisely. He was very successful at everything that he did. "And Saul set him over the men of war." He gave him a battalion. He gave him, you know, a group of soldiers that they could do covert ops. "And he was accepted in the sight of all the people." He became a fan favorite that day when word got out about him. It was all over Twitter. "And also in the sight of Saul's servants." Saul's servants saw the heart of this young man and what he was like when he lived. And it came to pass as they came, "when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, and they're singing and dancing, and they're meeting King Saul, and they got tabrets and joy and instruments of music and giving them tacos and everything." And now it's time of a, you know, worthy of a great celebration. 18:7, "And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his 10,000s. This was not a good mantra for a king with an ego problem. David didn't instigate the praise. He had earned it, but he didn't ask for it. "Oh, Saul only kills thousands, but David's killed 10,000s. David's still single and eligible, too, right now. So what do you think the ladies are doing here? You know? And 18:8, Saul was, if they were translating this in today's English, and Saul was very pissed. He was very wroth. And the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000, and to me they've only ascribed thousands. And what can be more left, but he's going to take the kingdom from me. And Saul eyed David from that day forward. Let's keep an eye on this guy. I don't like him anymore. Saul made a conscious decision to keep an eye on David as a little jealousy set in. 18:10. And it came to pass in the morrow that this evil spirit from God came upon Saul. And he prophesied in the midst of the house, and David played with his hand. He's playing the instrument, as like at other times. And there happened to be a javelin, a spear in Saul's hands. Stop, pause, effect. Can you picture the scene? David's sitting there, you know, singing and playing the music. And Saul is just working himself into a frenzy, and there's a devil spirit. Jealousy's already there. And jealousy's opening the door for the big brother, murder spirit, to come in. All right? And Saul's mind is just, you know, he's bipolar. And he's just back and forth. All right. He's got a spear. Something wrong with a guy. It's like giving a crazy man a gun today, you know. He's got his spear. And he's playing with his spear. We're going to see that. That's a habit of his. You don't really want to be around him when he has this, because he's going to have a tendency to try and use it. Now, since he had lost the spirit from God, this couldn't be real prophecy. It says that he prophesied. People don't understand how prophecy works. All right, one translation more accurately reads, and Saul began to rave, you know, like a lunatic, which makes a lot more sense. Another one reads, and Saul fell into a fit of frenzy. David's music doesn't have the greatest effect on Saul this time, does it? It's not calming him down. Gee, music isn't the end all? No, it's not. 18:11. And Saul cast the javelin, for he said, I'm going to pin David against the wall with it. Whoomp! Right next to David's head. Well, I'll use David for target practice. And David avoided it out of his presence twice. He went and grabbed the, he went back, where's David at? Whoomp! Flung it at him again, and David got out of there. All right. This is the first of at least 11 efforts of Saul trying to murder David. The jealousy spirit opened the door to Saul getting possessed with a murder spirit. All right, 18:12. And Saul was afraid of David. You'd think it'd be the other way around. But Saul's afraid of David because the Lord was with him and was departed from Saul. Therefore, Saul removed him from him and made him a captain. He made him a commander over 1,000. He gave him 1,000 troops now. What would that be, Matt? Captain, major, 1,000 troops?
Probably captain or major, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And he went out and came in before the people. You know, he went about doing his business as head of his troops. He had 1,000, you know, troops with him. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways. He proved himself a skillful, you know, captain. Very successful. And, again, the Lord was with him. That was why. You know, remember, he had the Spirit of God. God would help him, show him what he needed to do, and he'd do it. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself wisely, that he was always successful, you know, he didn't come back nicked up, you know, he didn't come back with injuries and all of that, nor did his men. And he, you know, at any age, it doesn't matter if you walk with God, God will take care of you, and that's what happened here. He was really young, and, you know, 15, he's fighting a bear and a lion, you know, 17, he's fighting Goliath, now he's starting getting into his early 20s and all of that, and he's winning wars. All right. But all Israel and Judah, oh, he was the poster child. They all just loved David because he went out and came in before them. He led them in their campaigns, and he was successful every time. War heroes are always popular with the people. Many of our presidents have been war heroes, starting with George Washington, Andrew Jackson, Zachary Taylor, Ulysses S. Grant, Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight D. Eisenhower, unfortunately, has been the last general who has become president. And, of course, I know many of you thought, what about William Henry Harrison and the great ticket? Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. Don't you remember that slogan from the 1840s? Okay. He was one of the presidents. He was elected in 1840 and died a year and a half in. And then Franklin Pierce. I knew you guys, you know, were waiting for me to mention Franklin Pierce is one of the great brigadier generals of our day. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. 1817. And Saul said to David, "Behold, my eldest daughter Merab, her will I give thee to wife. Only be thou valiant for me, and fight the Lord's battle. For Saul said, let not my hand be upon David, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him." So he's going, if I kill him, it's not going to look good in the press. So here's what we'll do. We'll send him into battle, and we'll figure out a way to get him killed in battle. And David said to Saul, "Who am I? What is my life? My father's family in Israel, that I should be the son-in-law to the king? What have I done to deserve this?" Look at his attitude. Look at his heart. You know? He's not going, "Yeah, I deserve this, sucker. You know, look at my bling."
Did you promise me something?
Like, thank you. That's coming. I've already been promised this, but he's going to make him earn it. Yeah, exactly. But it came to pass at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David. Oh, she was given unto Adrian, somebody else to wife.
Ooh.
But Michal, Saul's daughter, she fell in love with David. And they told Saul, and this thing pleased Saul, not in the good way, for the wrong reason. He's going to use this to try to get David killed. Wasn't he already, like Tim brought up it, wasn't he already supposed to have received the daughter of the king as part of reward for slaying Goliath? Yes, he should have already had one. But Michal, she just really loved David, so we've got an excuse here. 1821, and Saul said, "I will give him her, that she may be a snare to him." See, I gave my daughter to Matt to be a snare. That was all my thinking behind it. He's going to get a motorcycle, and we're going to... No, look at this conniving king. And Saul said, "I will give him her, that she may be a snare to him." That's always a good reason to give your daughter in marriage. "And the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Wherefore, Saul said to David, "Thou shalt this day be my son-in-law in the one of the twain." What's the movie Battleship at the end? "I'd like to marry your daughter." "No." Liam Neeson. "No." "What? I just saved the world." "No." "It's David. I just saved the whole everybody from Goliath." "No." "But yes, hey, and here's why. Aliens are going to come." All right. And Saul commanded his servant, saying, "All right, commune with David secretly. Go to David and say," he's getting his little guys together and saying, "Here's what you need to do. Tell David this. Saying, behold, the king has delight in you." No, you guys know I don't. "And all his servants love thee. Now, therefore, be the king's son-in-law." And Saul's servant spake these words in the ears of David. And David said, "Seems it to you a light thing to be the king's son-in-law, but I'm a poor man. I'm lightly esteemed." You know, look at the humbleness in him. And the servants of Saul told Saul and said, this is what David, how David responded. And Saul said, "Doggone it, I got to figure out a way to get rid of this guy." All right, here's what you say to David. "The king desires not any dowry. I know you don't have any money. But here's, instead, I want 100 foreskins of the Philistines to be avenged of the king's enemies. But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of Philistines. Go out and kill 100 of the enemy, and you can have my daughter." Oh, good plan. I mean, if you're Saul, I mean, let's try this. All right. Here's Saul's second attempt on David's life. This is a thought out, fully calculated plan to rid his kingdom of David. 1826. "And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David." Okay, I like this. "To be the king's son-in-law." 100? That's all? "And the days are not expired." Okay, basically, David is given a time limit to accept this offer. Here's my daughter. You have until Wednesday of next week. You need to go get 100 foreskins of the enemies. All right? You know, David's like, "I have no money for dowry, but I can win her heart through battle. This I can do."
You pretty much do.
1827. "Wherefore David arose, and he took his men with him, and he slew of the Philistines 200 men. And David brought their foreskins, And he gave him the full tale, the full number to the king. You can see them pulling up bags, he's dumping them from the king. Look at this king, I have 200 of them. I could be the king's son-in-law. And so was Saul lost. What do you do? You take me, call. As a wife, you can take my daughter to wife. We'll bring in a polka band and we're going to have a great festivities here. That's right. David brought double the amount that was required of him. For those of you who understand this, she was this 8-cow woman.
Yes.
Okay. This had to be disconcerting to Saul. Samuel had told Saul that his throne was going to be given to another who was better than him. And this guy David sure seems to be the guy who's about to, take the kingdom from me. All right, 1828. And Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David. It's obvious. And that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. And Saul was yet the more afraid of David. And Saul became David's enemy continually. He lived to see David die. That was his whole purpose now. What a nice father-in-law. Have you checked the brakes on your motorcycle recently? Saul's fear opened his mind to a murder devil spirit. See what jealousy and envy mixed with fear can lead to? Thinking of ways to dispose of David totally consumes Saul now. All right, 19:1. And Saul spake to Jonathan, his son, and all his servants. Guys, you need to go kill David. Well, that's pretty blatant, isn't it? He's not even hiding it now. This is now the third time. Just go kill him. Premeditated murder. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Now, therefore, I pray thee, take heed to thyself until the morning and hide in a secret place. Hide yourself there. Find a little secret place. Find a little closet and hide there. And I'll go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will commune with my father of thee, and what I see, that I will tell thee. And Jonathan spake good of David unto Saul his father, and said unto him, Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he hath not sinned against you, and because his works have been toward thee very good. Everything he's done has been very good. He speaks very highly of you. He does exactly what you want him to do. Again, this gives us insight into how David was perceived by others. Sometimes bad things happen to good people. David is guilty of doing his job too well. Unfortunately for him, he falls prey to the jealous, suspicious eyes of his boss, who just happens to be the king, and his father-in-law. 19:5. So again, Jonathan's fighting for David, and he did put his life in his hand and slew the Philistine. And the Lord wrought a great salvation for all Israel, and you saw it, and you rejoiced in it. Wherefore then wilt thou sin against innocent blood, to slay David without a cause? And Saul hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan. Saul said, as the Lord liveth, I'm not going to kill him. He won't be slain. Jonathan's sound reasoning and his love for David got to Saul. It temporarily stopped him from listening to the murderous devil spirit. He regains his sound mind for a short period of time. The meds kicked in. He's kind of balanced and he's okay for a while. Saul's love and all of that overrode the murderous devil spirit. All right, 19:7. And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan showed him all these things, and Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. And there was war again. ... All is well until war breaks out again. You can see Satan is manipulating the circumstances to try to get David killed. David's in the Christ line. He wants him dead. Verse 8 again. And there was war again. And David went out and fought with the Philistines. And he slew them with a great slaughter. And they all fled from him. And the evil spirit from the Lord was upon Saul as he sat in his house with his javelin, his spear in his hand. And David played with his hand. He's playing the lyre. He's playing the harp. And Saul sought to smite David to the wall with a javelin. But he slipped away out of Saul's presence, and he smote the javelin into the wall. And David fled and escaped that night. Another great victory by David. Saul's jealousy once again opened the door of his mind for a murder spirit to take control. David was still playing the lyre for Saul as part of his duties. I would think he'd try and do it from behind a wall or a little bit of protection. Here, you're staying here for a second. Will you, Jonathan, while you play? Or something. And Saul still pulls out a spear. He just liked to hang around with that thing and threw it at him. But David was still playing the lyre for Saul as part of his duties, even though he's a leader of a brigade. He's a top general. He may have thought that this would help to control Saul. If I keep playing this, it has worked in the past. So here's the fourth time that Saul tries to have David killed. The fifth time is going to follow immediately. 1911. Saul also sent messengers unto David's house to watch him, to slay him in the morning. David went home, and they're all waiting outside. They got their ninja suits on and everything, and they're waiting for him. To leave in the morning, they're going to grab him. All right? That's what the plan was. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If thou save not thy life tonight, tomorrow you're going to die. You're going to be slain." How did she know? Someone from the palace may have tipped her off about her father's plan. Remember, she was a princess, and she also knew what her father thought. 1912. So Michal let David down through a window. Tied the sheets together and under cover of night. "Look, Halley's Comet. Get out of here." Slid down the sheets and all that. And he went and he fled. He got away. He escaped. And Michal took an image. Took a mannequin from the local store and laid it in the bed. Put a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster. Put his hair there, in the goat's hair. Covered it with a cloth. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick. You can't see him." And Saul sent the messengers again to see David, saying, "Bring him unto me. Bring him in his bed if you have to. I want him dead." And when the messengers were come in, behold, there was an image in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster. And Saul said to Michal, "Why hast thou deceived me? My own daughter, be it not so. And you sent away my enemy, that he escaped." And Michal answered Saul, "He said unto me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill thee?'" "I'm not going to be a part of this plot. He said, let me go. So I did." And she was the one who helped get him out of there. Saul's take was that David was his enemy and his own daughter had betrayed him. 1 Samuel 19:18. So David fled and escaped. And he ran to the Samuel in Ramoth. Where would you go? To the prophet to find out what's going on. And he told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naathah, the summer home of the prophet. This was a very wise decision. Go to the man of God who had anointed you for advice. Samuel had to know that if Saul actually killed David, he would be next. All right, 1919. And it was told Saul, saying, "Behold, David is at Naoth in Ramoth." And Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as appointed over them, the Spirit of God was upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. All right, this isn't accurate. One text reads, "They became like prophets." Saul sends his elite undercover operatives to capture David. This is the sixth attempt on David's life. Verse 21. And it was told Saul. So he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. And Saul sent messengers a third time. He's sending his top KGB now. And they prophesied also. Then went he also to Ramoth, and came to a great well that is in Sekah, and he asked and said, "Where are Samuel and David?" And one said, "Behold, they are in Naoth at Ramoth." And he went thither. There, and the Spirit of God was upon him also. And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naoth in Ramoth. And Saul strips his clothes off, and he prophesies before Samuel in like manner, and laid down naked all that day and all that night. Wherefore they said, "Is Saul among the prophets?" Okay. Why did he take off his clothes? To look religious, to call attention to himself. Nobody else prophesied that way. You don't read Samuel. Anytime he needed to give a prophecy, he took his clothes off. A little bit more spiritual action going on than what's coming from the true God here. And I have dealt in a couple of situations like this where a person who is possessed does exactly the same thing. Yeah, you guys will know one of them. But it's the whole part of the thing to look religious. That's not true prophecy. That's not what happens. Now, we're going to read Psalm 59. In fact, Jack's going to read Psalm 59 for us because Jack has a distinct, clear voice, and we'll read this with emotion and empathy and heart. This is actually a record of the memorable thoughts of David when Saul sent messengers who watched David's house to kill him. What was going on in David's heart and mind at this time? Well, we have insight into it of Psalm 59 right here, and Jack will read this for us, Jack.
Deliver me from mine enemies, O my God. Protect me from them that rise against me. Rescue me from evildoers and save me from bloodthirsty men. For lo, they lie in wait for my life. Fierce men band themselves against me, not for my wrongdoing nor for my sin, O Lord. They make hurried preparations without any guilt of mine. Rouse thyself to help me and see. You therefore, O Lord God of armies, the God of Israel, awake to visit all the heathen. Show no mercy to these villains and traitors. Spare none of these who treacherously plot evil. Selah. They return at evening, snarl, growl, howl like a dog, prowling about the city. Behold, they belch, foam out with their mouths. Swords are between their teeth. They say, who can hear us? But you, O Lord, simply laugh at them. You make fun of these pagans. O my strength, I will sing praises about you. You are my fortress. My compassionate God will precede me. With God's help, I shall gloat over my watchful foes. Don't kill them, for my people soon forget such lessons. Rout them, ruin them with your might, and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. For the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, let them even be taken in their pride, and for cursing and lying which they speak. Consume them in wrath, consume them, that they be no more. And let them know that God rules in Jacob unto the ends of the earth. Selah. When they return at evening, they will snarl like dogs and prowl around the city. They roam about for food and growl if they do not get their fill. But I will sing of your might, yea, I will sing aloud of your loving kindness in the morning. For you have been my fortress and refuge in the day of my trouble. Unto thee, O my strength, will I make melody. For God is my fortress, my strength. He is my gracious God.
Quite a bit of difference there. Some people would think he's hiding out for his life and he's running terror stricken. No, not at all. He's saying, God, take care of my light work. But don't kill them. Just show these people that they're not, make them miserable. And meanwhile, I'll escape and glorify you. All right, 1 Samuel 20, verse 1. Almost done with this section. And David fled and came and said before Jonathan. Remember the last time this happened, he went to Jonathan? What have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin before your father? Why does your father hate me so much that he seeks my life? Jonathan had been an intercessor before in behalf of David. David's not bitter. He's just trying to figure out what he has done wrong to deserve this kind of treatment. He is hated by Saul for being successful. Not everything always goes right all the time for good people. And it's not necessarily because you've done anything wrong or because the consequences of sin. There's a devil. And he said unto him, verse 2, God forbid that thou shalt die. Behold, my father will do nothing, either small or great, but that he will show it to me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. And David swore moreover and said, my father certainly knows that I have found grace in thy eyes. And he said, let not Jonathan know this, lest he be pained, distressed, or grieved. But truly as the Lord lives, and as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death. So together they're going to devise an action plan. So jump to 1 Samuel 20, verse 24. And let's see what happens. 1 Samuel 20, 24. So David hid himself in the field. When the new moon was come, the king sat down to eat meat. And the king sat upon his seat as other times, even upon a seat by the wall. And Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side. David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul spake not anything that day, for he thought something might have happened to him. He's not clean. Surely he's just not clean. Something's wrong. And it came to pass on the morrow, which was the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said unto Jonathan his son, wherefore comest not the son of Jesse to me? He wasn't here yesterday. He's not here again today. And Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, let me go, I pray thee, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother, he hath commanded me to be there, and now I have found favor in thy eyes, let me get away, I pray thee, and see my brother. Therefore he cometh not unto the king's table. All right, that was the plan. Let's see Saul's reaction. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said unto him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman! Do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thy own confusion, and unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness? You know, to the shame and disgrace of your mother. He's bringing his mother into this. You know. For as long as the son of Jesse lives upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch unto him, for he shall surely die. Now, this is really intriguing, because Saul's appealing to Jonathan's self-interest. Jonathan's the oldest son. He's the one who should be the next king. And Saul is reminding him that his future as king's at stake here. Jonathan, if you ever want to be king, you better listen to what I'm saying and you better comply. Now, will David's good friend, David's BFF, will he betray him for the throne? David has to take this into consideration when they meet up again later. Is Jonathan going to accept Saul's bribe? Is he going to fall for this? Hey, it's the kingdom that's at stake here. What will Jonathan do? We'll be back in 60 seconds. All right, 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 32. And Jonathan answered Saul his father and said, wherefore shall he be slain? What has he done? And Saul cast a javelin at him. At Jonathan, he grabs a spear and he throws at his own son to smite him. It wasn't just a love tap, I'll get it close. He was going for the jugular, literally. All right. Whereby Jonathan knew that he was determined of his father to slay David. So Jonathan, arose from the table in fierce anger. You can see him knock the table over and throw his wine cups at everybody and walk away, And he didn't eat the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David, because his father had done him shame. His father had insulted him, had disgraced him. Verse 20:41. And as soon as the lad was gone, remember, they had devised this plan, and so David's just, outside, in the little shadows, hiding behind a palm tree or something. And then, as soon as the lad was, basically, he shot an arrow, said, go get my arrow, so the guy took off after him. David arose out of his place toward the south, fell on his face to the ground, bowed himself three times, and they kissed each other, and they wept with one another, oh, my dad wants to kill you, he really does, you need to run. Oh, you're such a good friend, thank you. I'm glad you didn't sell out for the kingdom. And so they kissed each other and cried and all of that, and then they departed. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for as much as we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever. And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went back into the city to his crazed, possessed father. I'm going back home, and David, you need to run for your life.